I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night, in a closed-door session, House Republicans debated whether to strip Liz Cheney of her leadership post after she voted to impeach President Trump in January. The secret vote ballot was 145-61 that she keep her number three job in the GOP. Republicans did not punish freshman Marjorie Taylor Greene for spreading false and incendiary conspiracy theories and supporting violence against House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats. Today, the House will vote in public about whether to strip Greene of her Education and Budget Committee appointments, a move that was orchestrated by the Democrats. Joining us is Claudia Grisales, and she is congressional reporter for NPR. Claudia, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about today's vote, let's talk about what happened last night. What was the mood in the room?
So it appeared to be a pretty tense situation for these Republicans. They crammed into this room. This is the pandemic age, so they were in a larger room on Capitol Hill in the visitors' center. And they were there for several hours, about 4 hours all told. And they had to cover this widening gap that they're facing in this party between these controversies with Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has espoused these QAnon conspiracy ideas, other kind of violent ideas, and whether to allow Wyoming's Liz Cheney to remain in her leadership role. She's the number three House Republican because she voted to impeach the president. She did call for a vote to ensure that she had the confidence of the conference, and she got it with that vote tally that you just shared moments ago.
61 people, though, voted against her. Let me just quote what she said about why she voted for impeachment. She said, "There has never been a greater betrayal by a president of the United States of his office and his oath to the Constitution." Those are tough words, Claudia, but she obviously stood by them.
She really did. And so what we're seeing here is the establishment party, Liz Cheney is part of that, trying to make its mark in the Republican Party. Time and time again for the last several years under former President Trump's administration, we've seen this populist wing kind of swallow up the establishment. And although they didn't pick a side last night, if you will, we did see Cheney hold on to her leadership role and making that stance. She had a vote of conscience, and she voted to impeach the president. And she was affirmed last night by most of the caucus last night.
61 people voting against her. Is that significant, do you think, Claudia?
I think that is telling, because that shows where we're seeing this party tear at the seams. We're seeing this very kind of loud minority in this case, and perhaps that's the case in for the larger Republican Party, that still wants to stick with Trump. You know, they have this fierce loyalty to the former president. It's a bit ironic. They lost the House, the Senate, and the White House under his presidency, but there is a very deep loyalty there. It also tells you that a lot of these members are worried about their primaries, and they don't want to upset Republican voters in their districts. They feel safe in their general races. They think they can pull that out as a Republican, but they have to get past that first stage. And in those cases, they have to meet up with a lot of supporters for the former president. And they're also sticking with that script in terms of just their self-interest of staying alive in their own seats, even if it costs national influence.
Well, which I think is one of the reasons today's vote, which will be out in the public, will be so interesting to watch. And this is something that the Democrats kind of foisted on the Republicans, correct, Claudia?
Very much so. Democrats gave Republicans, specifically House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, about 72 hours to take care of this issue with Greene, that is, remove her from her committees of education and labor and budget. And he did not. He negotiated or attempted to negotiate with the House Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, in offering up an exchange that he would pull Greene off of the Education Committee because that is so controversial. She's made these very disturbing claims about staged school shootings. And so he offered to pull her off that committee, but not others, and perhaps put her on another committee in exchange for pulling her off of that one. Hoyer said he was not pleased with that offer and said Democrats have no choice but to move forward with this resolution. The House Rules Committee held a hearing on this yesterday, and today is the floor vote. This is very unprecedented because we haven't seen an opposing a majority party pull an opposing party's member off committees, and this could really open up a new stage in this war between Democrats and Republicans. If Republicans were to gain the majority again, it could backfire. And even Hoyer conceded to this, that Republicans could try and yank Democrats off panels if they gain control again.
What I think is so interesting in all of this is that McCarthy said last night that Marjorie Taylor Greene did apologize. She doesn't believe in the conspiracy theories that she had espoused. Is there any chance she would speak to that publicly so that all of us could hear it?
It's really hard to say. And yes, it's really hard to hear an apology when it's not made publicly. It's made behind closed doors, and she's very defiant outside of that on her Twitter account. She's fundraising off of all of this. She recently said she raised $160,000 off this push to remove her from these committees or remove her from the House completely. So it's very difficult to kind of see an opportunity there where she would decide to make a public apology, especially when it's this heated, this controversial, this much is at stake, and Greene is not going there.
Hmm. Do we know why she was appointed to the Education Committee of all the committees? As you said, she has made these false accusations that the school shootings never happened. I mean, it's just sort of horrifying to think that someone would not just think that, but would say that, knowing, of course, the suffering of the families and teachers in the school community involved. But who picked her for the Education Committee?
This is House leadership. So McCarthy's going to be part of that decision. And this is a question that has been thrown around. Why, of all the committees, did they pick education for Greene? That's really difficult to reconcile. We heard that from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi just recently. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said this as well, as you really have to look at the origin of where this decision came from, and they pin that on McCarthy and other House leaders for making this call.
I'm curious about which Republicans you'll be watching today as the vote proceeds.
It will be really interesting to see these moderate Republicans, how they handle this decision, because they have really, through all of this, especially in the last year, especially since the insurrection, we've seen these moderate Republicans speak out against some of the concerns involving Trump while he was president and within their own party, and this effort to overturn the election. So this will be another day that these Republican moderates are going to be tested in terms of what direction they go in, because it is difficult in terms of this chapter, this new chapter that Democrats could open today, which is, again, this decision to remove members of the opposing party, the minority party, when they're in control. It sets a tough precedent, and it's going to put a lot of members like these moderate Republicans in a tough spot because they've spoken out against Greene, and they could move forward with a vote to remove her. But again, it's a difficult precedent to set.
Mm. I'm looking at something that Jim McGovern said. He's House Rules Committee Chair, obviously a Democrat. He's from Massachusetts. He said, when a person encourages talk about shooting a member in the head, they should lose the right to serve on any committee. I mean, it does raise a question about where is that bar? And I'm thinking actually of what happened to former Congressman Steve King. He lost his committee.
Exactly. And this is what Steny Hoyer was telling his caucus. He didn't want to see Republicans do anything less than what they did with King, who didn't express such violent ideas, such specific threats against sitting members of Congress, such as Pelosi. So that was the concern, that they needed to meet this bar that they did with Steve King. McCarthy removed King from his committees, but we're seeing a new test with an even more difficult case with even more grave concerns. And Hoyer saying they didn't pass it. And so this is what's triggering the events we'll see happen today.
And is McCarthy trying to sort of tread his way through these various wings of the Republican Party?
Yes, for sure. He's trying to thread this needle between these two opposing factions of the party that, if you will, Trump left behind his presidency, which is this populist wing, the Trumpism versus the establishment. And so you could see that play out last night. And that's what he did. He basically backed Cheney and backed Green. Didn't back her ideas. He did speak out against them publicly. He did it again yesterday. But he's trying to make it a big tent that includes these traditional conservatives and, you know, these extremists at the same time.
Claudia, we have a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye to you, but I'm thinking of the Senate impeachment trial that's going to start next week on Tuesday. For our listeners, what should they be looking for, listening for?
So this is going to be another test for the Republican Party. Initially, it appeared that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was opening the door to a possible conviction of former President Trump. That would have swung a lot of his members his way to raise this potential of a conviction. McConnell will be a key figure to watch. He has softened his tone towards Trump in recent days. And as we saw with the recent vote questioning whether the trial was constitutional, only 5 Senate Republicans broke with their party to say that the trial is indeed constitutional. These are the ones that could vote to convict. We could see a few more join them, but it would be really critical what McConnell does and says in the coming days to see if any more join them.
And the Senate would need 2/3 in order to actually convict President Trump.
Exactly. They need 17 Republicans to join Democrats for a conviction, and that appears right now to be a very tall order.
And how much is the next election influencing the various moves in our Congress?
So a lot of what we're seeing with House Republicans, for example, right now, the ones who are remaining, these fierce Trump loyalists, they're the ones who are really focused on their districts. They want to see if they can win the House back. On the other side, we see the Senate talking about broader national messages that go back to their establishment core ideas of supporting individual freedoms and a strong national defense. And so they are focusing as well on the Senate to see if they could win back control. It's a 50-50 chamber, and that's very much a possibility. And there's very competitive states in play in 2022, for example, Pennsylvania, now Ohio, as well as North Carolina. Democrats see a chance to grow their majority, but Republicans hope that won't happen.
Claudia Grisales, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she's congressional reporter for NPR. We've got 2 guests who'll be joining us for the rest of the hour talking about the future of the GOP. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. As we just heard, later today, the House of Representatives will vote on whether to strip freshman Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of her Education and Budget Committee posts. This vote is orchestrated by the Democrats, who argue that her dangerous and unhinged QAnon-inspired conspiracy theories and threats of violence against Democrats make her unfit to have a committee post. While while House Republicans refuse to take her off these committees or censure her, some Senate Republicans have not held back. Mitch McConnell said, quote, loony lies and conspiracy theories are a cancer on the Republican Party and our country. On Monday night, Green tweeted in response to McConnell's criticism, the real cancer for the Republican Party is weak Republicans who only know how to lose gracefully. Today in Radio Times, the future of the GOP amid infighting, the upcoming impeachment trial, and the attack on the Capitol. Let me introduce our two guests, John Brabender, joining us by Skype, national Republican strategist with Brabender Cox, which is located across the state in the Pittsburgh area. John Brabender, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here.
And also with us is Greg Nunziata, and he's a Republican attorney, former advisor to Senate Republicans, worked with the late Senator Arlen Specter. Greg Nunziata, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we've already got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Here's our email address, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Interested in particularly from hearing from the Republicans in our audience. Greg, let me start with you. What should the Republican Party do about Marjorie Taylor Greene?
Well, I think generally the Republican Party needs, I think every political party, every political movement needs to police itself and be wary of those who want to fly under its banner, who bring along a lot of poison that the party or movement doesn't want to be associated with. And I think Republican leaders in Washington, Republican opinion leaders in the media and throughout the country need to speak out pretty strongly against this. I think, removing her from her committee assignments would have been a way to signal that the party does not stand for her agenda. I understand they are not doing that, and there's a fair case to be made that the party shouldn't penalize a member for something she said before she became a member, and that's largely the case here. But I think, you know, leaders are going to be called on to respond to things she says going forward, and they need to be carefully attuned to that.
Well, just a quick follow-up. Why, though, do you think the reluctance, to use your language, to police itself or even to push back against Marjorie Taylor Greene?
I think some of it is the institutional point I made about the concern about presidents for punishing members for things they said before they got elected, not in office. But of course, there's an energy out there on the populist right, which includes elements that are open to or encouraging of conspiracy theorists and conspiracy theories. And, you know, politicians may have some reluctance about taking on elements that are activated and are eager voters, but they're going to need to. I mean, leaders need to lead and not just respond to the people and not kind of in a defensive position of fear.
John, let me go to you picking up on that. I was reading some articles about what the GOP did, gosh, a generation or two ago when they had to deal with the John Birchers, who were, in many ways, when you read about the John Birchers, not unlike QAnon, saying all sorts of dangerous and conspiratorial things. The GOP eventually ran them out of the party. What does the Republican Party do with someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene? And there's some others who are, you know, trading in some of these QAnon conspiracy theories. What does the party do about them?
Well, first of all, I think there's really two issues that we have to look at here. One is the rhetoric itself. And then the second is the whole idea of free speech in this country. So when I look at this, I think the Republicans move quickly, particularly Senate Leader McConnell, in discrediting her, criticizing her views. I think the same thing happened in the House with McConnell and others. Yesterday, in fact, she backed away and said that she had made a terrible mistake in supporting some of the things she did without having full information, without understanding it, and it was a different point in her life, and said she no longer is there. So I think the whole idea is to move quickly. Now, what's happening is the Democrats, on the other hand, aren't accepting any of that. And what they're trying to do is to make this into a political issue, despite the fact that you have a candidate who was elected by people who will vote on her again. And I do think we get into very, very dangerous territory, and we increasingly are in this country, with saying that if I don't agree with you, or even if I think you are outside the mainstream of this country, we are going to take away your voice. We saw that with what Twitter did. Look, I've been very out in front in saying that President Trump used Twitter in a way that I thought was extremely divisive and disagreed with many of the things he did. But that doesn't mean that they have the right to take away his voice. I think most of the people on this show right now would agree that if somebody standing next to us was burning the American flag, we would find that reprehensible. That doesn't mean we have the right to take that away. In fact, I think what makes this country so remarkable, so exceptional, is that sometimes we allow speech that we totally disagree with, even find vile, but say in this country, you have a right to be able to stand up and give an opinion. And so I think we've got to be careful here to say, how do we deal with when we see something that's in disagreement? I think we have to be unified in our offense to it, but to always be just now taking more and more freedoms away because we disagree with something, I think is starting to get on a very dangerous path, quite frankly.
John, let me pick up on a couple of things that you just said there. And apparently McCarthy said that she apologized. This would be to the Republicans. It was in a closed door session and that she's disavowed some of the things that she had said. Seems to me, because she has been so vocal about, and these are not just differences of opinion, these are dangerous conspiracy theories, that she owes it, maybe to her party, maybe to the country, to the families of, you know, whose children were murdered in schools, to be public about her disavowal, if that's what she really does. A couple days ago, she was not going to back down, but that she needs to be public in her disavowal of these really incendiary and dangerous ideas and frankly, threats that she has lobbed.
Well, the people she has a responsibility to clarify her position to are the people that elected her and she represents. Those are the people that have the right to understand exactly what she believes now. Why did she believe what she did earlier? And she does have that responsibility to go there. She doesn't have that responsibility, frankly, to Nancy Pelosi. And so when you
she didn't directly threaten, but she retweeted something that basically threatened Nancy Pelosi's life.
Well, I think some of that's open to interpretation. You have AOC now saying things that I thought were totally reprehensible when she was saying that the Republicans are trying to get her killed. Do we really believe that
is? I'm sorry, John, I have to stop you there. Equating AOC and Marjorie Greene is just not a fair comparison. You may disagree
with
AOC.
You are saying a statement that you were saying she made about Nancy Pelosi, which is very similar to what AOC was saying in some regards, accusing the Republicans of as well. And so my point is, you know, you can't have it both ways here. You can't have AOC say this explosive, you know, sort of rhetoric and say, oh, but that's AOC. Oh, but we're going to go after the Republicans because now we're in charge. You know, the best thing that's
John, I got to stop you. In January 2019, Green liked a comment that said, quote, a bullet to the head would be quicker, unquote, to remove House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Right. And she is paying a price for that. Universally, our party is criticizing it for that. She is being penalized. She's going to be penalized in losing status within what committee assignment she has. All these things are happening. She owes an apology to people. But the point is for the Democrats to decide that everything that happens that they don't like, they are going to turn into some type of managing everything for political purposes only. I mean, frankly, do you think people really voted in November saying, boy, I hope to God the Democrats go down this route of impeachment again? They want people to get rid of the divisiveness. They want people to get along. They want people on both sides to say, there are people hurting in this country. Why don't we focus on the issues that really matter to them? But
all right.
Out of Washington, again, with the Democrats in charge of politics.
Yeah, I mean, in response to that, President Biden has put a lot of issues on the table to deal with all the problems that this country faces. I don't want to ignore our other guests. Let me just get you back in, Greg, into this conversation. I do want to move off of Marjorie Taylor Greene, but at the same time, it's a very important vote today. And here she is, you know, she has espoused these statements. Do you think she should publicly disavow them?
I mean, of course, it would be helpful if she publicly disavowed them. It would be helpful for her and her own career, and it would be helpful for the Republican Party. I think we should be asking her to do so.
But how do you see, perhaps even looking at Liz Cheney, who is very conservative, has that marquee name. She did get to keep her post as of that vote from last night, but 61 Republicans voted against her. Do you, Greg, sort of see this split in the party between the sort of Romneys and the Cheneys versus the Marjorie Taylor Greens and people on her side?
I don't think that you can equate those 60-something Republicans with Marjorie Taylor Greene, but obviously there's some energy in the party that is closely tied to supporting the former president. I don't think it's ever a healthy thing for a political party to be identified more with a personality than with its principles, and the Republican Party is going to need to get back to asserting its principles, clearly. And we can have a big tent that includes a wide range of center-right leaders and center-right voters. You know, when I started in politics in Pennsylvania, we had two senators, two Republicans, mm-hmm. Senator Santorum and Senator Spector, who were pretty different personalities and had very different agendas, but there was more than enough room for them in the Republican Party. And I think that going forward, we will need to build a new governing majority. And I think that that has room for a wide range of policy views, but it shouldn't have room for conspiracy theories or really kind of dangerous rhetoric of the kind we're talking about.
And I'm curious about, because we do want to talk about, we need strong parties in this country, including a Republican Party. How do you see rebuilding that party, Greg?
Well, I think it's always hard for a party to find its voice and find its coherence when it's lost elections and when it doesn't have a president. You know, there'll be different factions struggling for what the path forward is, and lots of leaders in Washington around the country are working on how to figure that out right now. I think we can all have varying views on the Trump presidency, but it's certainly clear that he reached a lot of voters and a lot of voters who felt abandoned or discouraged, disillusioned with politics. And the Republican Party is going to want to continue reaching those voters. He, of course, also lost some support for Republicans. You think about a place like Pennsylvania, and think about 2016, a more traditional Republican like Senator Toomey performed rather well in the Philadelphia suburbs, not as well in, say, Northeast Pennsylvania, where with President Trump it was the opposite. So there'll be a challenge of knitting those two things together. But, when I think about what was the Trump administration, what is Trumpism, there's at least two major threads there. And one is a more populist kind of public policy orientation, and one is more a populist posture and messaging, rhetoric that can be diverse, divisive, and alienating. And I would hope that we would find the best from the first column and leave aside the second column.
John, how do you see building or rebuilding, whatever word you want to use, the Republican Party, knowing, of course, that this is a country with a changing demographic? It's going to be a majority-minority party in just, a couple of decades.
Well, I agree with everything said so far in that the party does have all these different factions, if you will, right now, and the key is putting them together. And I want to point out one thing. One of those groups happen to be Democrats. If you look at a state like Pennsylvania, Trump did very, very well with blue-collar Democrats because of issues like trade. And the Republican Party wants to continue that. So they are going to look at things like taxes, trade, dependence on foreign oil by getting rid of the Keystone Pipeline and hurting fracking. They're going to look at they're also going to look at this dramatic shift that the Democratic Party seems to have to the left and how they're different than that. But the wild card of all this, and I'll be the first to say our party's been a failure at this, is understanding the new impact that younger voters are have. Millennials and Generation Z are at 37% of the vote right now. Particularly Generation Z is showing up in big numbers. They voted this year as 18 to 23-year-olds. We saw with younger voters, there was a 10-point increase in turnout from the 2016 election. They voted overwhelmingly Democrat. interesting enough, they voted overwhelmingly Democrat for Biden, despite 44% of them saying they had an unfavorable viewpoint of Biden, which means that they thought Trump was even worse, you know. And so our party has a tendency in the past to say younger voters don't show up, and eventually when they pay taxes, they're going to become Republicans. It doesn't work that way anymore. And if our party doesn't wake up and understand that we can't do things like, say, climate change doesn't exist, we lost that message by the time younger voters were basically in the third grade. We have to have substantial issues and ways and narratives to talk to younger voters in a way we haven't ever before, and certainly did not in the 2020 election.
Greg, let me go back to you, and there's just something that has been kind of bothering me, to be perfectly honest with you, and this is the mob that attacked the Capitol, more than three weeks ago, and the numbers of police officers or Metro or Capitol Hill police who were assaulted by this mob, serious injuries we are learning about. One person died as a result of his injuries. There were two suicides. I haven't heard very many Republicans kind of stand up and criticize that mob for that behavior. I know there's criticizing Democrats for, you know, defunding the police, but I don't hear, or I haven't heard very many Republicans who, in a sense, are criticizing the mob for what it did to the police who were there.
I think most Republicans have criticized what happened in one way or another. Have they done it enough, loudly enough, and in a sustained enough fashion? I'm not sure. I'd love to hear more from Republicans about that day. I mean, I spent over a decade of my career working in Congress, and just those images and knowing Capitol Police officers and seeing lives lost, it's just kind of a heartbreaking thing, and it was truly a traumatic moment for the country, and you know, it could have been much uglier when we read about what some of the folks in that mob had planned. So I agree. We should not move on past this. I think too many Republicans are a bit eager to move on because of the ways in which Democrats are approaching the impeachment. They're viewing it, Republicans are viewing Democrats as taking a partisan approach to this, making it all about Republicans or all about President Trump, when they'd prefer the focus to be more on the mob and the lawbreakers. But I think we're going to need to address it, and we'll be talking about this for weeks and months to come.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. That's Greg Nunziata, Republican attorney, former advisor to Senate Republicans, John Brabender, national Republican strategist with Brabender Cox, the future of the GOP. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with John Brabender. He's a national Republican strategist with Brabender Cox, which is located in Pennsylvania. Greg Nunziata, Republican attorney, former advisor to Senate Republicans. He actually worked with former Senator Arlen Specter. And we're talking about the future of the Republican Party, how it deals with some of the divisions within the party, certainly on display in the last couple of days. We're especially interested in hearing from the Republicans in our audience. What do you want for your party? Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a smattering of comments here, and I'll give you a chance to respond. From Terry, the Republican Party seems less interested in democracy and more interested in power. Doesn't it seem to be favoring an oligarchy? Are they using issues that incite only to gain a following to accomplish their ultimate goal, absolute power? An email from Michelle. No, the fundamental problem with the Republican Party is that as an institution, it continues to espouse underlying beliefs in anti-democratic structures and limited government. Or as Ronald Reagan stated, government is not the solution, it is our problem. from Adam, I worry that the media is repeating a mistake that was made when Trump first ran for president by spending so much time covering Congresswoman Green. Just a smattering of comments there. John, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think there's some truth to that, because what happens is all the conversation is based upon sometimes just a single out of step with the rest of either party sort of a thing. And that becomes what we're all focused on. And that becomes the branding of either the Republican Party or the Democrat Party. And I think that's how we cover politics today. And I think that's a shame. But I also want to say one other thing. When you said Republicans didn't criticize Capitol, the storming of the Capitol, I do think there was significant criticism. But putting that aside, I think there are certain events, Charlottesville, that event, where we have to put aside the R and D after anybody's name and say, as American citizens, we have a responsibility to come together and criticize that as one. That it's not about politics, it's about who we are. And there is a responsibility in all these. The thing that's going to happen now, as far as the Republicans goes, that you have to understand is the Democrats own everything. And so what really moves politics is less about what you sort of agree with, but more about what the other side is doing when they're in charge. For example, the great unifier in 2016 for the Republicans and a lot of the country was Hillary Clinton unified the Republicans. And we saw that Donald Trump unified various factions of the Democrat Party, the socialist wing, the centrist, and so forth. They had one common enemy, Donald Trump, quite frankly. It's going to be real interesting to see who's really in charge on the Democrat Party. Is it the socialist wing? Is it Joe Biden? Is it Schumer? Is it Pelosi or whoever? And that's going to determine a lot about how unified the Republican Party is, quite frankly.
Well, and John, you and I have gone back and forth about this. It's the Democratic Party, not the Democrat Party. And there we go. I just have to put that out there because I think it does need to be said. But let me go back to you, Greg. In terms of leadership, and it does raise questions about whether former President Trump is still the leader of his party. He got more than 70 million votes, so clearly he has a lot of support in this country. Is he the leader of your party?
No, I don't think so anymore. I think he's the former president, essentially retired to Mar-a-Lago. We saw this again, not to stick on this Marjorie Taylor Greene story, but reportedly, President Trump was personally pushing members of Congress to Liz Cheney. I'm moving on to Liz Cheney. He was personally pushing members of the party to vote for removing Liz Cheney from leadership, and he managed to get 60 votes. You've seen the leader of the Senate Republicans, who is the most powerful Republican in Washington today, condemn the president's role in the events that led up to the storming of the Capitol on January 6th. You've seen Mitch McConnell in a variety of ways trying to organize the Republican Party in a new orientation. So no, I don't think the former president is the leader of the party today. I think he's a significant factor who has millions of very ardent fans and supporters, and that's a part of our party, but it is no longer what defines the party.
Who do you see as emerging as a leader, or perhaps a troika of leaders for your party, Greg?
I think it's really too soon to know. Obviously, there are a lot of voices right now. Again, I think Mitch McConnell is, for all practical purposes, the leader right now. And what he is trying to do is create a space for that next generation of leaders to come forward. There are some very thoughtful Senate Republicans with different policy views, but certainly all with different styles than President Trump. There are a number of strong Republican governors across the country. So I think it'll take time. It'll probably take another couple of years before we see really who are going to be the dominant voices for the next decade.
Do you see people waiting in the wings, John Brabender?
Well, I think what happens is we're certainly going to have our leaders, McCarthy and McConnell, but they're in the minority. And so I think what you're going to see rise up are all the potential 2024 candidates. There was a survey just out a little over a week ago where they ranked all the top 20 Republicans, and by far the highest was Mike Pence, had the highest favorable rating, followed by former President Trump. The lowest was Mitt Romney. And so, you know, one thing I will say that I feel confident about, that whoever is our next nominee is not going to be a moderate. It's going to be a conservative. We are a conservative party. And so I do think we're going to start seeing a lot of people rise up who are looking at 2024. They're going to have the loudest microphone, if you will. And that's who's going to drive a lot of where our party is going in the next 2 years.
Well, speaking of Mitt Romney, I just got this news flash. He just unveiled a child allowance plan worth $250 a month for older children, $350 a month for younger children, up to $15,000 a year for a family. So that's all I have. I don't have anything to add to that. But just since you mentioned his name, I think that is interesting. Let me go back to you, Greg. Looking at that polling, Romney's near the bottom. He ran for president not so long ago. What does that tell you about the party, that someone like Romney just doesn't seem to connect with a lot of Republican voters?
Well, you know, a lot of it is stylistic, and a lot of it is connected to the historical moment we lived through in the Trump administration, where Republicans felt very intensely bonded to the president. Many of them did. And they viewed someone like Mitt Romney, who would criticize President Trump, as being disloyal. And it's the dynamic that I think the president helped create by casting everything in us versus them terms. Mitt Romney is not the far left of our party. He's no Arlen Specter, for instance. He's a pretty mainstream conservative. But for the last few years, the Republican Party has been, to its detriment, I think, excessively identified with the personal political interests of one person. And we need to move past that. I agree that we're not a moderate party. It's not going to be a moderate who leads us back to the White House. It'll be a conservative. The question is, what type of conservative? And that's what I think we're fighting over now. And both on the policy front, whether we are shifting in a more populist direction on trade and other issues permanently, and also kind of in the messaging front. I think that we really sorely miss a more aspirational voice in the party. And I think that goes to what John was talking about Republican struggles with younger generations. We need to be painting a picture of a future in positive terms for this country, and not solely in kind of the dark and defensive terms that the former president's rhetoric seemed to rely heavily on.
Greg, do you see Republicans, though, afraid of the base, afraid of the Republican Party base?
Yeah. I mean, politicians are always a bit afraid of their core voters and their base voters. And there's always a dynamic between politicians and their constituency. And some of that is healthy. But it is damaging if leaders fail to lead on particularly matters of principle. And I'm hoping that we'll see more of that going forward. The media environment is another factor here. A lot of what John was talking about earlier, about what voters see, is how things are covered on cable news and on talk radio. And it's just a really misleading framing of what's happening in Washington.
What's a better framing?
Well, of course, NPR.
I wasn't fishing for that. I promise you, Greg. No, what's a better framing?
Well, I mean, the simplest advice to news consumers is to read and watch and listen widely and expose yourself to views that you don't hear from a lot. Because I mean, that's, I think, fundamentally a dynamic that underlines a lot of what's wrong with our politics today, is that increasingly Republicans and Democrats are living in closed media ecosystems. They're talking to people they already agree with. And the other side, the other party, is more and more like a foreign country.
Let me read a couple of comments, and then, John, I'll give you a chance to respond. One from Tommy says, the future of any party is fraught. If we don't address the filibuster, the budget reconciliation is just as problematic. An email from Dave, is it a bad precedent to eliminate committee assignments based on what a member believes? This feels like a thought crime enforcement. A comment from Corrine, I'm very disappointed that Toomey hasn't spoken out more about this and is instead attacking Biden's climate agenda. Moderate Republicans must be a moderating force against anti-Semitic, racist, and violent voices. John, anything you want to say back to our listeners there?
Well, First of all, I'd say not just moderates, but conservatives, and I think they are often, should be loud voices against racism or anything that's anti-Semitic. And you know, and I often see that there is sort of a perspective from the left that, you know, that conservatives have these values that are completely different than what they are in reality. Or when you hear people say, oh, well, the Republican base. And oftentimes they're talking about this sort of fringe element and act like they're our base. Our base are, you know, older men and women in small towns, blue collar workers that go to the plant every day, suburban moms who are raising. I mean, our base is actually pretty broad. I mean, let's not forget, we're even in the Senate. We have more governors. We have more legislatures. And I think there's a pretty good chance the Republicans are going to take back the House and the Senate in Washington, and we just had the presidency for 4 years, where we nominated two Supreme Court justices. So the Republicans aren't exactly doing badly. It's just that what we have to do is be smarter in what we do. We have to, for example, show more diversity in our party, highlight, you know, where we have diversity of who's elected. By way of example, even just women, we have some remarkable women that were elected to Congress this cycle, younger women who should be front and center so that we can show that, you know, they still believe in our conservative Republican values, but they're a new generation of a type of Republican who abhor the divisiveness in Washington and ran against the gridlock in Washington. We have to make sure that we're telling our story better, because I see a lot of misinformation, or our brand sometimes is punished unfairly because of people having perceptions of what the Republican Party standpoint, because of a small group of loud people who oftentimes get the megaphone more than anybody else.
What about former President Trump? What role does he have? Or what role did he play in creating the situation we're in?
You know, it's a good question, because he certainly has a remarkable following. And what a lot of people have to understand is, even among Trump supporters, I would see this in focus group after focus group among Republicans. They very much, though, were uncomfortable with the tone and tenor that he would often use. But they would look at it and say, but I really strongly agree with his agenda. And frankly, before COVID came along, he had our economy going to record levels, and it was an inclusive economy where you had African Americans doing better than they ever had, Hispanics, women in the business were doing better than they ever had. But the problem is, oftentimes Trump would step on his own message with his rhetoric, which would take away from the accomplishments he was having. I think what most people want to get back to is the Trump agenda of what he was fighting for. And I think they will rally around those ideas, but they're not going to rally around, I don't believe, the divisive rhetoric anymore.
Greg, here's a Facebook comment from Dorothy. She says, there can be no moving forward or bipartisanship until there is accountability. What do you say back to Dorothy?
I suppose I'd ask accountability for what? But I mean, I agree that if we're talking about the events that led up to January 6th, that, yeah, there ought to be accountability. And I understand that many Republicans do not support impeachment or conviction, but they sure as heck ought to support a thorough examination of what happened, whether anyone who was serving in office in our party contributed to the environment that made the breach of the Capitol possible, whether decisions were made by the former president that delayed sending relief to Congress, as well as mm-hmm. mistakes that may have been made by Congress itself. I mean, January 6th was a horrible day, and there certainly ought to be accountability, and there ought to be many, many prosecutions of the people who entered the building that day.
Well, and Greg, we're almost out of time here, but how important is it for Republicans to say to their supporters, Biden is the president, the election was legitimate, no one stole the election? How important is it to say that?
I think it's vitally important. I think the failure to do that for the weeks that led up to January 6th played not the primary role, but a part of creating the environment that led to that day. So I think we absolutely need to reassert our fundamental commitment as Republicans to the Constitution and to the institutions that make this country great. And that includes our elections, which are messy, and certainly there are problems and irregularities, but they are legitimate.
We're going to leave it there, Greg Nunziata. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Republican attorney, former advisor to Senate Republicans, John Brabender, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. National Republican strategist with Brabender Cox. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.